If I may, I'll tell you two stories about election night. But first, on election night, Jerry and Mary Helen had gone out to dinner at this place they just recently tore down. It's the old chain house. I can't remember the name of the restaurant. But,
on the east side?
Yes, on Jefferson Avenue. Just recently was torn down. And
oh, I haven't been down that way in a bit.
Well, doesn't matter. But and I went to the suite that we had arranged for at the hotel. We had put a special phone in there. Remember taping red tape around the handle of it, and there was another phone, but no one was to use that red phone because Freddie Romanoff and Jerry's brother, now Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Michael Kavanaugh, were over at the city-county building, and they were going to get the results and phone me as soon as we had something. Polls closed at 8 o'clock, and if my memory is accurate, it was, I may not be accurate, but it was 8:25. Freddie called and said that the city clerk had already announced that Kavanaugh was the winner. The 25 key precincts showed that Kavanaugh was winning everywhere in the city. Those 25 were used as test precincts. And those 25 showed Jerry winning in all of them, as I recall. And Jerry hadn't come down yet. There were only a couple of other people in the room. I remember Tommy McIntyre being one. And Tommy said to us, "Now don't anybody make any statements to the press." So they're going to try to sucker you fellas into some kind of a statement. So let me do all the talking to the press. And he did. Much to Jerry's annoyance, he told the press how he had engineered this entire thing. And he had won the election almost single-handed. Well, anyway, the funny thing of that night to me was Vince Brennan, the giant, wonderful man. Vince and I, at Jerry's request, had gone over to see Jerry Moore, who was managing the Fort Shelby Hotel a couple of weeks before the election night, to arrange for our victory celebration. And Jerry sat there and listened to us for a while, and he finally said, coming to reality, I said, "How much money have you fellas got?" At that point, we didn't have anything. And he was very nice about it. He said, "Well," he said, "instead of the ballroom, which we had asked for," he said, "supposing I give you, there's a nice party room up on the, I think it was the 21st floor or something like that, sky room. And you can have that." And he said, "instead of the open bar," he said, "why don't we just limit it to beer?" Well, we argued with him as best we could from a point of not having any money. We couldn't argue too much, but we finally got him to agree to let us have the ballroom anyway. Because we said we're going to have enough people that will need the ballroom. We just can't get them into that room up there, which might hold 60 people. But we'll go along with the beer. So he said, "All right, I'll go out on the limb for the ballroom and the beer." Well, election night came. We get the report that Jerry is winning, and all of a sudden people start streaming into the ballroom. And streaming along with them, I see employees of the Fort Shelby Hotel carrying cases of scotch, rye, what have you.
Yeah, the victors belong to spoils.
Everything opens up. Suddenly we've got a full-line bar being distributed.
That's funny. But Mr. Kavanaugh himself surely was not surprised.
He was not. He came down to the hotel as calm as ever. He never showed any real surprise at the whole thing. He assumed he was going to win. He was confident of his win. Of course, he was a cool person under any circumstances. He never, never allowed himself to be flustered or appear flustered.
Let's talk a bit about Mr. Kavanaugh's years in office. What do you think his perception of the condition of the city of Detroit was when he took office in 1962?
Well, the city was fortunately in better shape financially and all than it is today, but even then it had its difficulty, and as you know, he came out for an increase in taxes. Mm-hmm. He may have been the only political figure who ever campaigned, among other things, for an increase in taxes during his initial campaign. Mm-hmm. I remember getting a call from somebody who was shocked that he was going to come out for an increase in taxes, and I said, but he talked that all through the campaign. And he said, yes, but I didn't believe him.
That's an interesting twist.
Yes, isn't it? So, with the increase in taxes, there was sufficient money to meet the needs of the city. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, he believed that the city should campaign for, let's say, an attitude of open housing throughout the neighborhoods, fairness and race relationship. He strengthened the committee that was involved in race relations in the city, and he worked very hard, if with not total success, in the police department to try and get them to recruit more blacks. I can recall him insisting with the then chief of police, a fellow named Lou Reuter, that the next class would have to be 50% black. Mm-hmm. If I remember rightly, the conversation that occurred a little while later, Mr. Reuter proudly announced that he had gotten 25% black into the class. And Jerry was very upset about this because he said, I insist it be 50% black. Mm-hmm. Because they were already so far behind the race relationship. There's a number of blacks to white officers. And it never did achieve the level that he wanted all the time he mm-hmm. was there. And he spoke frequently with the various chiefs of police and police commissioners, George Edwards, who was certainly race relations conscious, about getting a better representation in the black community and the police department. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of great resistance in the police department at that time. Finally, the things have changed and for the better. But Jerry was never entirely able to get his philosophy into the department, but he certainly did increase the or improve race relations during mm-hmm. his time in there. Mm-hmm.
Was racism then a major problem in the ranks of the Detroit Police Department in 1962? Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think there was a perception that it was. Uh-huh. As you know, they had that, what's the name now? It slips my mind at the moment. The police officers who would act as decoys on the street, they'd walk down the street carrying usually a gasoline can.
Right.
So it looked like they had run out of gas and were on their way mm-hmm, to the car. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. That was the program that was put in place by Mr. Mariani?
Yes.
Late in his administration?
Right, and that was what had caused tremendous resentment. Mm-hmm. Well, there was some resentment on the part of the department that Jerry cut that out. Mm. But it was effective in that a lot of people were arrested as a result of this. Got a lot of armed robbers off the street, but on the other hand, it was so resented in the black community that the real effect of it was very negative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was tremendous amount of resentment as a result of that. It's like trolling down the streets in the black community, trying to lure people out to commit a crime so you could arrest them.
Was there any sense of a brewing adversarial relationship between the Detroit police and the black community in 1962 that
no, I don't think
emotions
so.
Were really getting heightened?
I think with Jerry's election, when he was elected at the end of 61 and started serving 62, the race relations right away began to improve. Honestly, because Jerry had been elected with the help of the black community, mm-hmm. and many blacks were appointed to positions in government. Mm-hmm. And I think, I speak as sitting here as a white man who never could have totally shared the experience of the black man and woman, but that it appeared to us, at least, and I hope we weren't fooling ourselves, and I say us, I mean the general run of people who were in Jerry's administration, that relationships were much better. Mm-hmm. All of that was to end, unfortunately, with the riots in 1967. Mm-hmm. Many people said, concerning the riot, that Detroit would be the one place where it wouldn't happen because the race relations were so good in Detroit, and that black people had a real opportunity in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Of course, this was not necessarily how the black community felt. This was the white observation mm-hmm. of the community. Mm-hmm. But Jerry, interestingly enough, contrary to what I have heard and read on the part of many, said to me one day, he said, you know, we could have a riot in the city. He was talking about running for the Senate. And he said, if I'm going to run, I should run before any of that happens, because once we have a riot, then my image would not be the same and I couldn't successfully run.
What caused him to make that comment?
I probably can't give you a real answer to that question. We were sitting there in his office that particular day talking about the Senate campaign and should he or should he not run. And I was one who strongly opposed him running and felt he couldn't carry the black community. Pardon me. And that was his response to my argument.
Hmm. Why didn't you think he could carry the black community?
Well, I was not in the administration at that time. As I mentioned, I had left. I had run for prosecutor unsuccessfully, had gone to the Attorney General's office for a year and a half, and then ran again for prosecutor, again lost. It took me two turns to learn that I couldn't win that race. I have to interrupt myself. They ran very well. They kept running a fellow named John L. Sullivan. Without John L. in there, I could have won easily, but the weatherman couldn't do it. Well, anyway, one day, Jerry, who was head of both the National League of Cities and the U.S. Conference of Mayors, was going to the two conferences, one being in San Francisco and one in Miami, and he asked me if I would take soundings to what I thought his chances would be, and would meet him in Washington as he was going through from one to the other, and we would discuss this thing. He later told the same story to a WJR reporter one day, so I'm not breaching any confidence in telling it. So when I came down to Washington, I had talked with a lot of people in the black community, uh-huh. primarily, and I said to him when we met in Washington, you can't carry the black community because they owe this to Williams and they will support G-Men and Williams even against you. Therefore, if you can't carry the black community, you can't carry Detroit. If you can't carry Detroit, you can't carry Wayne County. If you can't carry Wayne County, you can't carry the state of Michigan. So uh-huh. you just can't win. And I thought I had convinced him with that sort of comment, but he didn't say definitely. He said, well, we'll talk about it more. Uh-huh. Well, the next day, he went on to Miami, and I came back to Detroit. And we met again on it on a couple of occasions and discussed it. And finally, it came to the point that he said, all right, tomorrow, this was a Friday, he said, I will let you know what I'm going to do. And Bob Toohey and Jack Casey and I, Jack was now with the administration, of course it was Bob who said, DSR, I think, at that point, met at the mayor's office, and I bet them each $5 that Jerry was going to say no, he would not run for the Senate. At a little after 9 o'clock, we went down to his office, and he said, I'm going to announce 2 weeks from today that I'm a candidate for the Senate, or whatever day it was he was going to announce. He said, I'm doing it in Escanaba. I remember I was thunderstruck. I was thunderstruck that he had decided to run, but more so when he said, I'm going to announce in Escanaba. And I said, Escanaba doesn't have any television. You can't announce in Escanaba.
Why Escanaba?
Somebody had told him this would be a great thing, get the outstate vote, go up there to the Upper Peninsula, where, comparatively speaking, few votes. Well, he didn't announce in Escanaba, he announced in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there we were, and off and running on the Senate campaign. But I just didn't feel there was ever a chance of winning. We had taken a poll, which cost at that point $7,000, which then was a fairly expensive poll, and it showed that Williams would win. Mm-hmm. And we didn't change a thing in the whole campaign. As I mentioned, Jerry told that story, part of it, but the part of it that got him in was this. The Friday night, I told you we were going to meet Saturday morning and he would announce his decision.
Right.
Friday night, he had gone to one of these exercise places out on 8 Mile Road, I can't recall the name of it, and ran into Doc Green, who was a news reporter.
Right.
Now, the AFL-CIO at that time, and a person named Gus Scholl, Gus was head of the AFL-CIO, and he made a statement. It was carried on the front page of the papers. If Jerry Kavanaugh runs for mayor, we're going to take him to the woodshed and give him a good spanking. Well, when Jerry ran into Doc Green, Doc said, I've written a column about how you're ducking out of the Senate race because of what Gus Scholl has said. And Jerry said to him, as Jerry relayed to me, he said, I told him, don't write that column, don't run that column, because I'm running. So apparently on that challenge, swung his decision to run.
Gus Scholl's challenge.
Yeah, now Gus Scholl, later on, spent all kinds of time denying that he had ever in any way provoked Kavanaugh, but he had.
Do you think the story is true, then? That Scholl actually had said that?
Oh, yeah, actually said it.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
I don't think Scholl ever denied saying that. He just never denied that he had provoked Kavanaugh to the point of getting him in the race. Not that ordinarily Scholl would care one way or another if he had provoked Jerry into getting the race, but it made for a very strong primary. Jerry was anti-Vietnam, you know. That was another one of his principled positions. At that time, it wasn't everybody that was willing to come out against Vietnam. Jerry was very, very close to President Johnson, had been invited time and again to the White House, and Johnson frequently would call Jerry. And when Jerry came out and said that we should be out of Vietnam, Johnson just cut him off.
You know, is that right?
As far as he was concerned, there'd be no more help for Detroit. Hmm. But I know I'm leaping around something else.
It's all right.
One thought provokes another.
Uh-huh.
And so I saw the campaign that, unlike the mayor's campaign, a lot of money came into that campaign.
So it was going to be an expensive campaign.
But not nearly enough to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
When we ended, we were about $200,000 in debt.
Mm.
And I was back in the administration, and I was given the thankless job of raising the $200,000 to pay off the balance of the deficit, which finally, in the 3 years, we succeeded in doing.
Some columnists at the time also implied that one of the reasons why Mr. Kavanaugh failed in that primary was that his relations with the state Democratic Party were not as good as they could have been.
That's true. But I don't know that that's why I lost. I mean, it's true that the relationship was never that good. Mm-hmm. Jerry was just not given to playing the glad hander with the Democratic Party.
Uh-huh.
He was a loyal Democrat, and he supported the party's basic stands, always financially had his people contribute to show up at the Jeff Jack dinner and things like that. But he was not about to march to the orders that came out of Democratic Party headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil Stabler, who was then chairman of the Democratic Party, particularly, I think, offended at this, and unfortunately developed a very bad relationship to the point that I think Neil made some very strong, unfair, and inaccurate accusations against Jerry.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was a personality clash?
Oh, it became more than a personality clash. Neil bitterly resented Jerry having run. G-Man and Williams, unfortunately, suffered physical setback during that campaign. He lost his gallbladder or something like that. And physically, it was an effort for Williams to make that campaign. He won it, and probably would have won it easily. I don't think that there's any question, but he was going to win right from the opening gun, unfortunately. But Jerry, by the fact that he decided to run, earned Neil Stabler's undying enmity.
I see. The other major power in the state Democratic Party at that time, obviously, is UAW.
Yes.
What was their position?
Well, their position was pretty much pro-Williams, as most organizations in the party were pro-Williams. I don't know that the Democratic Party at that point, they realized that Jerry was a very fine political person and one that they didn't want to alienate either, so I think there was a little, they basically were for Williams, but they weren't trying to alienate Jerry either by their stance. Speaking of that, reminded me of one funny personal story. I thought my mother-in-law lived with us, and she was a great admirer of Williams. And somehow or another, he found out about this. And so early one Sunday morning, I was just getting out of bed, having been out working the hustings late the night before, and a car pulled up in front of the house, and G-Man and Williams stepped out of the car and came to the front door.
And he
He said, "I'm here to meet the supporter I have in this house."
Did he really? Oh, my. No, that's a great story.
Unfortunately, my mother-in-law was at Mass.
What was your reaction?
Dumbfounded.
What could you say? You got you on the spot on that one.
Yeah. It showed a certain wry sense of humor in the band.
What were relations like between Mr. Kavanaugh and Walter Ruther?
Well, I think they became rather good after Jerry became mayor. I think the UAW was obviously impressed with his performance as a mayor. I can remember I was party to none of the conversations, but I remember being in the office on different occasions when Walter Ruther would call, or Jerry might be calling him, but I know they consulted, talked. Mm-hmm. I was never present when they met, so I never sat in on anything, but I know that we got a lot of support in those days from the UAW. And even after the senatorial campaign, nothing really came of it, but after the riots, Walter Ruther called. I was present when that call was made, I didn't sit in on the call, he sent me in the office, and volunteered the help of the UAW in cleaning up the city. Uh-huh. Nothing ever came of it, but at least he was calling and volunteering, yeah.
It seemed that Mr. Ruther had a personal interest in many of the same areas that were high on Mr. Kavanaugh's list of priorities. The Model Cities Program, urban renewal, public housing, civil rights, obviously. It seems like there are some rather distinct parallels in terms of their public policy positions in many ways, their opposition to the war.
I think it took a little while for them to warm up at all because the UAW was strongly supporting Mary Annie, and see Jerry win without any help from them sort of set them back politically in the city, and it took them a little while, I suppose, to adjust to that. But the relationship with Jerry and the union, in the end, I think was very good. Uh-huh. Al Barber, the AFL-CIO, was a very strong supporter at times of uh-huh. Jerry's.
Was a rather blunt question, I guess. Was Mr. Kavanaugh the sort of political leader who would carry a grudge in the sense of, you didn't support me in the campaign, you supported my opponent, so now there's nothing I can do for you in my administration?
No, exactly the opposite. When Jerry won, he had almost no support from what we might call the business community. Mm-hmm. But the reality, whoever is mayor immediately at least gets the offer of support from that same business community. Mm-hmm. If I may illustrate, I said the campaign cost us $25,000 and we ended up with no deficit, I thought. Within a matter of a few days, I found we had about another $25,000 deficit because people who had done things for free, now that we'd won, sent a bill for the services. There were printers who volunteered to print material, and when Jerry won, I found a bill on my desk to pay for their printing supplies and things like that. But at the same, we accepted, under Jerry's orders, I say we because Ollie Nelson, who was one of Jerry's law partners, and myself, on the day after the election, were approached by people whom I didn't even know, offering sums of money to take care of any deficit we have. Regardless of what it is, we'll take care of your deficit. But Jerry had said, the window closes at 8 o'clock. Polls close at 8, the window closes at 8. Except nothing after 8 o'clock. So none of these people were allowed to make any contributions the next day. However, the Chamber of Commerce, Board of Commerce, whatever they call it, had a party always last, I think it was last week of December, and that was sponsored by and for the business community. And Jerry was invited and received a very gracious, warm welcome from those people and was invited to participate in many of the civic affairs. And he said, we have to work with these people. And I think he became very friendly with many of them. Well, Henry Ford, for example, and the Fords had supported Mary Annie, but Henry Ford became a supporter of Jerry's, mm-hmm. As did Mrs. Ford. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mrs. Edsel Ford, she was very active in community affairs, mm-hmm. and both she and Henry Ford gave significant contributions to Jerry later on for re-election, mm-hmm. and, even in the Senate race. Mm-hmm. So his relationship with the business community, I think, became very warm, certainly with Chrysler officials, too, because he wanted to involve the Chrysler officials, particularly in city government, in that they had the largest payroll of people in Detroit.
Right.
And he went out to see them. He took me along on this particular day. We met with the top people at Chrysler. And he asked them to designate some of their people who would serve on committees and even wanted someone to take a full-time job as head of the DSR. Mm-hmm. Chrysler didn't want to part with anybody on a full-time basis, but they did work very closely with us and many other things.
What about the General Motors people?
During my time, I can't recall any particular development of relations with General Motors. But again, remember, I was gone after 6 months, and then I came back for the last 3 years. I came back from the Senate campaign to the end.
Mm-hmm. This starts getting into a rather nebulous area, perhaps, of Mr. Kavanaugh's years in office, but every office holder, I suppose, to a certain extent, has his own style of running his administration. The kind of structure that he sets up in his offices, the chain of command, and that sort of thing. Could you speak a little bit about that? Did any reorganization take place in Mr. Kavanaugh, takes office and the way in which he ran City Hall.
One of the things that amused me is every candidate for mayor that I've ever heard to talk about he's going to open up City Hall. Jerry was the last of the mayors that I knew that ran an open City Hall. Mm-hmm. Jerry's office door was always open. Mm-hmm. Not all appointees felt that free because Jerry didn't want to be interrupted by everybody with every problem, and so he wanted the appointees generally to set up a time so that it fit them in on the schedule rather than just casual walk-ins. But strangers would walk in. Anybody really that wanted to walk in could walk in. There were only a few of us that were allowed access to the mayor's office at any time. Freddie Romanoff, Bob Tuohy, myself were always allowed access. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was pretty much that you should get an appointment mm-hmm. Through the secretary and see him. Reorganize? No, I think the departments as they were set up, he changed people who ran them. But the basic structure of city government remained the same. But he had a very hands-on attitude toward running the city. I don't mean as Jimmy Carter, who even scheduled, I understand, who could play at the tennis court at the time. But he wanted to be very much involved in the work of each department. And he wanted each department head to keep him fully informed, and did, both by memo and in person.
Was Mr. Kavanaugh good at delegating power?
Yes. He would not hesitate to delegate to those, well, like Freddie Romanoff, Bob Tuohy, whom he had great trust in, and he would delegate great authority to them.
You've mentioned on several occasions now Mr. Kavanaugh's relationships with television media. Is Mr. Kavanaugh part of the new generation of politicians in that sense, who are very sensitive to the media and went out of their way to maintain good relations with them?
Yes. Many people at that time compared Jerry with John Kennedy. Uh-huh. There was a great something that you saw in each of them. Uh-huh. They were both very interesting people, very witty, excellent speakers, and both were very cognizant of their relations with the press and always had excellent relations with the press. Uh-huh. As I mentioned, any newspaper, television man, what have you, or woman could walk in any time to his office. Uh-huh. And he always had a good repartee for them. He could come up with something for them instantly, and he wasn't afraid to answer questions.
Do you think this was a conscious effort on Mr. Kavanaugh's part in any way to emulate the example that President Kennedy was setting, or was this just part of Mr. Kavanaugh's part?
He was that sort of a person. He was just a very open, warm person who it wasn't only with the media. There was a man, he ran a bar somewhere in the area of the city county building, and he would stop to give Jerry advice. And he'd just walk in, and he would start telling Jerry what he ought to do about this or about that. And Jerry would listen in the same kind of way he'd talk with anyone else. He was just a very open sort of a person. Uh-huh. Not everybody would do that, I assure you, but this fellow felt somehow or another. I don't know which bar he ran, because I don't think I was ever in his bar, but I'd say, who is he? He's a nice guy. It's all right, let him in. Well, he was just very easygoing with people.
Okay. I think we've covered that. One of the goals that we have mentioned already that was a particular area of emphasis for Mr. Kavanaugh was in the area of race relations. There were a number of others that he mentioned during his campaign and a number of other issues that he seemed to stress as mayor. One was in the area of education. Could you discuss a little bit Mr. Kavanaugh's perspective on the educational needs of the city of Detroit and what plan of action he attempted to implement in that area?
You're aware, of course, that the mayor has no authority over the education system in Detroit. Yet, people perceive somehow or another that the mayor has or should have and frequently turn to him for some guidance in that particular area. I can only recall on one occasion early in the administration, there had been difficulties in the schools. Didn't feel they had sufficient money, as I recall, and may have been threat of teacher strikes and so forth. And the school board, and I, as I remember now, and my memory's not too sharp on this, the members of the school board and of the unions, teachers union, all met in the mayor's office one particular time because they felt that Jerry was one of the, already though he'd just been elected mayor, that he was someone who might be able to bring them all together. I deviate again because it shows something of Jerry's ability. He had some fantastic abilities. He had asked me to tell Dick Strickarts, who was one of his top aides, one of his think tank people, to prepare a document to present the problems of the school. And he had gone over Dick with the outline of what he thought should be done and so forth. And the meeting was due to begin something like, say, 9 o'clock in the morning. It might have been 10, but it was one or the other. And a few minutes before the meeting, and the people were already in there waiting in the camp, and Dick's position paper, as outlined by Jerry, was not there, and he asked me if I would go down and see it finished. So I went down, got it. They had already made copies for everybody in the room to get one. So I brought them back and gave the one to the mayor, and the others were being passed out in the conference room. He got up from his desk and walked slowly to the conference room, which can't be more than, I suppose, 30, 40 feet from the mayor's desk. He was going through the thing, just leafing through it as he walked. Well, I sat in on part of that meeting, and he began to refer to that document by page number. And, as you'd say, for example, on page 18, now we have suggested, and he would lay out a...
This is a lengthy document?
Yeah.
Did he have a photographic memory?
He certainly did.
Is that right?
He had tremendous retentive power. I don't know if you'd call it a photographic memory, but he had a retentive power. He would see something, and he would remember. Mm. Lyndon Johnson had that, too. But Johnson couldn't recall anything about it the next day, and unless the issue in front of him was Jerry would remember the thing. Uh-huh. Don't remember. He had a fantastic memory. But I can't tell you what, because the mayor was never that much involved in the educational issues of the city. Concerned about them, yes, but not that involved, nor did he have any authority to involve himself. Mm-hmm.
One of the areas in which Mr. Kavanaugh is noted for being in the vanguard of reform in urban affairs in the 1960s is in his various proposals for fighting poverty in the city of Detroit. Could you speak a little bit about the programs that he inaugurated, how he came about to develop these programs and so on?
That occurred after I was gone, but he set up a poverty program, and the first man in charge of it was Bob Brazell, as I recall. You may know Bob, excellent administrator. Outstanding. Mm-hmm. After Bob left, Dick, oh, come on, what's the matter with me? Dick Simmons took over the poverty program. Mm-hmm. And Jerry put a lot of himself into that program. He was particularly concerned about its efforts in the community and what it could do. He never...
When you say he put a lot of himself into it, what do you mean by that?
He met with the people who, the top people in that program, and even with the full staff over there, to try to keep up their efforts maximum level to do something about poverty. You know, there's only so much you can do about some of these things, but he was very concerned that on the issues of, as you mentioned, poverty and race relations, the underprivileged in the city, and trying to do something to bring them up. He was a man who enjoyed the good life. He enjoyed fine food, fine wine, but he was always very concerned, too, about the lack of some of the fine or the decent things in life for the poor people. He came from ordinary middle-class family. They weren't poor by any means, but neither were they rich. And as I mentioned, I suppose a lot of young fellows from St. Teresa's and St. Cecilia's weren't too cognizant of problems there, but he had a great depth of concern about that. And as mayor, I think he inspired people to try and do something in those particular areas. He was an inspirational person.
Another aspect of running a city like Detroit, especially in the 60s, you mentioned he had to increase the income tax. Another key aspect of improving conditions in Detroit was the necessity of attracting business, which is a constant problem for all city administrations, even then. Did Mr. Kavanaugh have any specific ideas or battle plan as to how he was going to go about convincing the business community to spend more money, generate more jobs in Detroit?
Well, we had an industrial and commercial development department in the city. City still has one, I believe, which was not too successful in bringing business in. It did improve, I think, when he put some people there himself. But he did it more through business people. For example, he worked very closely with Walker Sisler at Edison. Met often with Walker Sisler and got him to head up various committees to try to attract business to Detroit.
It's a name that comes up so frequently.
Walker Sisler?
Yes. Could you speak a little bit about him, some observations you might have about Mr. Sisler?
Well, I hate to say that I don't have too many astute observations. I sat in on several meetings with the mayor and Walker Sisler, all of which would be held at an early hour at the Detroit Club. Jerry was not given to early rising particularly, but...
By early hour, you mean after midnight or...
No, 7 o'clock in the morning.
In the morning, okay.
Mr. Sisler apparently was an early riser. He was earlier than I know Jerry was. Less that significance my own, like was to get up a little later, but we'd be there at 7 a.m., and he would talk about what could be done to make Detroit more attractive as a business place. And he set up some committees of businessmen for that purpose, industrial development committees and things of that nature. But again, most of that came after I had left. And so I think really to find out about those things, you have to talk with Freddie Romanoff or Bob Rozell.
Okay. One last area perhaps I might touch on before perhaps we might want to end this session. And we've touched upon it a bit already, but it was another area that was very important in Mr. Kavanaugh's first administration, and that was in the area of police reform. Perhaps one way of getting into that topic is to ask a rather direct question. Why did Mr. Kavanaugh choose George Edwards as police commissioner? Of all the choices that he may have had, why George Edwards?
I think that the suggestion came, if I am not mistaken, and I could be, because while I sat in on many of the discussions when we talked about who would fit in on that and other positions, that's one Jerry held very close to his chest. And if I am not mistaken, the idea came from Ray Girardin. At least if it didn't come from Ray, it was Ray who made the first approach to George Edwards. Jerry wanted to get a very strong personality, make a dramatic appointment to show that this was not just going to be any other administration, that he was going to bring in top people in top jobs. He had brought in Al Pelham, who had a man with tremendous respect in the financial areas in government. And Al was a great appointment, really made a significant difference in the city finances. But police commissioner, because of the problems in police-community relations, was going to be particularly significant. Mm-hmm. And so, as I recall, I had a lunch with Jerry and Ray Girardin, but they were still playing that one awfully close. Jerry wasn't even letting me know who it was. They spoke at this lunch rather cryptically about the candidate is willing to meet with you and so forth.
Why are they being so
secretive? He wanted to get out. Just wanted to make certain it did not get out, because if he turned it down, I mean, George Edwards was on the Supreme Court at that time. And it was a really iffy sort of a thing as to whether or not he would accept it. When he accepted it, after Jerry met with him